Theme song with 25% more coughing than last week.
Well, at least you're feeling better.
I am. My name is Dave White. I own this show.
That's so cute.
Alonzo Duralde.
How you think that.
Alonzo Duralde is this other person.
And this is a podcast of the cinema.
Yeah. So, yeah, I feel like yesterday we recorded LKTV one day late.
Yes.
Which is a thing that you can get if you are a subscriber to Patreon.
Mm-hmm. And join our club.
Us on Patreon. You go to Patreon, Patreon.com. And then you ask for Linoleum Knife by name. And you can become a member of our special club. Linoleum Knife is brought to you by, though...
Exile in Guyville.
The audiobook.
By Dave White.
By me.
Available at exileinguyvillebook.tumblr.com.
My 2006 memoir that went out of print and the publisher went out of business. And now I've recorded an audiobook version of it that you can buy for any amount of money that you choose at exileinguyvillebook.tumblr.org.
Com.
Com.
Stop it.
Net.
Biz. Biz. U.S.
CA. And, okay, so yesterday we recorded LKTV and we made it exactly 1 hour long. I have been sick all week, and it has hurt to do pretty much everything. Like, my body was achy, swallowing was really stinging and painful, talking for long periods of time was not great. I feel significantly better today than yesterday.
And not half as much as tomorrow.
Right, and so I'm gooder now, but this episode is still going to be short-ish because I'm not down for just jawing on and on and on today.
All right.
Normally, as everyone knows, I'm a talking man.
It's true.
I like to say things, and I like to make sure that it gets said so that everyone understands me.
Yes, well.
And that I'm right.
Poor you.
I've just today been it's not going to be like that.
I've just been dealing with a scratched cornea all week.
True. Alonzo has a corneal ulcer.
Yes.
You dug something into your eyeball.
No.
Like Buñuel.
Stop. No. I'm dry and scrapey, and my eyeballs are not juicy enough. And so blinking sometimes, it gets scrapey in there.
I keep trying to tell you, you need to become more juicy inside like me.
You know what? I'm genetically incapable of having a juicy eyeball. So I have to apply drops and unguents and salves and poultices.
It's not a poultice.
You know, I just like saying the word poultice.
Antibiotic glorp.
That too.
Is what it is.
Yeah.
But you're getting better too.
I'm getting better too.
Like the other day when I drove you to the doctor, your eye was like hanging out of a socket.
That's not true.
Blood and viscera covering your face.
I know it disappointed you that's not what actually happened.
In my fantasies,
that is not what happened.
You had an eyeball hanging out of the socket.
No, I had a damp compress pressed to my eye. That's about as intense as
it. But it was red. It was crazy red. Like,
yes. What they call an angry red.
It was an angry red.
Weirdly enough, I was supposed to do
Is that what the doctor said? An angry red?
No.
Oh.
That's not a medical term. Oh. I was supposed to be interviewed for a documentary on Friday, and I'm supposed to be doing one on Monday, but I'm kind of having to tell everybody I am not ready for my close-up.
No, you're not.
Because unless I want to do this in giant sunglasses, I think it would not be cute on the camera. So
you got a haircut, though. You look real cute with the new haircut.
Thank you. I'm very happy about the new haircut. I was needing it. I was getting rabbinical with the beard.
The beard was getting real big again, which is... You know, I like it, but it looks freaky on camera.
It looks freaky on camera, and if I had the time and patience to sort of sculpt a beard, you know, where I was constantly trimming the sides down and just letting the middle grow, I might be onto something there, but I don't, and so it just all goes out in all directions, and it's like an upside-down lion. It's not good.
The last couple of Instagram photos you took with, like, Matt.
Yeah, they were a little shaggy.
Strange.
A little shaggy, I grant you. We are on Instagram at LinoleumCast. That's also our Twitter handle. You can follow our hijinks there. And, only one big release this weekend, but a lot of cool indies. And most of them are good. Or at least a good half of them are good, that were the ones that we're going to talk about. Mm-hmm. We didn't see the new Terrence Davis, which we need to check out at some point.
Here's what I wanted to do this weekend. Mm. My big plan before getting sick was that I was going to go see Deepon.
Right.
And Sunset Song.
Right.
Sunset Song is the new Terrence Davies movie.
Correct.
Deepon is the winner of 2015's Palme d'Or.
Yes.
At the Cannes Film Festival.
Cannes Film Festival currently unspooling as we speak.
A director whose name I'm blanking on.
By the guy who made A Prophet. Jacques Audiard.
Yeah. And, but I had to go see Love and Friendship for this show.
Yeah, well, and also for KCRW, which you wound up bailing on anyway.
Thursday night I went, and I was that guy coughing all the way through it.
Hmm.
Actually, I was the guy being incredibly conscious of my coughing and making sure that I did it during loud parts of the score.
Mm.
People traveling somewhere and there's music.
Horseback.
Going. Yeah. Because I was so mortified by my own presence there. Also, I had to stifle all my laughter because laughing triggered coughing.
Right.
So I have to go see Love and Friendship again so that I can pay attention to it as much as I was having to pay attention to my own body's trouble.
Right.
It's such a great movie.
It is so great. Should we just launch into that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so Love and Friendship, it's the new film from Whit Stillman, who seems to be back on a semi-regular schedule of filmmaking after taking quite a bit of a gap between Last Days of Disco and Damsels in Distress.
Yeah.
It is based on a novella by Jane Austen called Lady Susan. And while it is his first adaptation of anyone, much less of Jane Austen, my feeling is that this movie sort of calls up how much he's been operating in Jane Austen mode all along.
Yes.
He is rare among filmmakers about being concerned with mores and etiquette and class and societal understanding.
A specific societal class.
Exactly. You know,
the Richies.
Right. And you know, characters who are head smart and heart stupid, but who very much exist in a specific context of what is accepted and what is done and what is allowed. And so even when his films are set in the recognizable modern day, the characters are as constrained by those influences as Austen's were.
Yes.
And so so this is sort of like Brian De Palma literally remaking an Alfred Hitchcock movie. Like, he's just totally in his wheelhouse here.
I in real life, I believe that most rich people have probably done something to get their money that would necessitate them being incarcerated.
If history has taught us anything, yes.
But in movies, I think they're delightful. And I especially find them delightful in movies like this.
Well,
where...
well, this is you're at least dealing with the actual aristocracy and not the, you know, the fakey one we have in this country. You know?
Correct. The there's an element of satire with Whit Stillman. I don't think he's really going for the throat ever.
Oh no.
For his crew, because these are his people.
Yeah.
No, I don't know where he comes from, but it's clear that he knows these folks inside and out, and has since Metropolitan.
Yes.
Did
I tell you that we got to hang out in Dallas?
Yes. But yeah. You should tell that to the audience.
Nothing major. I did a Q&A with him at the USA Film Festival for this movie, and we got to go have dinner during the movie. And he's about what you would expect Whit Stillman to be like. Kind of soft-spoken, right. But like every so often would say something either sort of devastatingly witty or would ask a question that was super incisive.
Right.
But very nice. I had a good time with him.
Like, comfortable to be around him.
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Because I feel as though with this film that he has finally achieved peak snoot.
Yes.
Because, as you said, this is the actual aristocracy in England in the 18th century.
Right.
And very much like The Witch, they're speaking, period.
Oh, yeah, no question.
The speech patterns, the words, the everything, they are speaking as aristocracy spoke at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, you better be ready with your ears and have read enough of this kind of literature.
But weirdly enough,
To keep up.
It's of a piece with his other films, even the way it people is. Talk. Like, there's even... It's funny because at USA, they were honoring him and they showed a clip reel beforehand. And there's that great line in Metropolitan where Sally Fowler says, through clenched jaw, "I despise snobbery and snobbish attitudes."
Right.
And then Kate Beckinsale has a very similar line to this film about despising snobbery or whatever. It's like, oh, come on! No, I think you're making it out to be more difficult than it is. I mean,
not more difficult, but
it is.
If you're waiting for the jokes, what you're going to have to wait for is a sort of sentence construction that is non-existent today.
That's true. Yes, it is period, definitely, but not, you know, too densely so that it's...
No, you just need to have some... You need to have some book learning.
And he does...
To deal with this movie. You just do.
Sure. And he does the thing in this movie that I love in his films, where it's like, someone will say something absurd, and it will be repeated like two more times. And it just gets funnier every time.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's one of those in this movie. Learn the name Tom Bennett.
Yeah.
Big in England, apparently. Don't really know him here.
I've never seen him before, to my memory.
Holy crap.
This dude's hilarious.
He is such a great scene stealer at playing such a wonderful doofus, or as Austin describes the character, a bit of a rattle.
Why don't you explain what the movie's about?
Okay, so Kate Beckinsale stars as Lady Susan, and she is determined to marry off her teenage daughter to someone of means, and maybe find herself a new husband of means as well.
Because she's a widow.
Because she's a widow.
Yes.
And so she is constantly sort of...
You say maybe as though there's a question.
Okay, yeah. She's looking for a rich husband for herself.
Let's be clear about who this person is.
Okay, fine. Yes. Yeah. She wants it all. And so she is sort of constantly staying with, you know, friends and relatives, you know, and being in society and kind of spinning off webs. And she has her allies like Chloe Sevigny, who plays the American wife of a nobleman played by Stephen Fry. She has her adversaries. She has adversaries that she turns into allies, and vice versa. It's all as I've said before, she's playing three-dimensional chess.
Yeah.
She totally understands how this world works and is just kind of spinning her way through it. And you know, Austin gets this world and Stillman gets this world. And so it's just exceedingly funny. And there's this great thing that they do because there's a ton of characters you have to figure out rather quickly. So the movie does this great effect they'll like freeze frame, or not freeze frame, but they'll do an iris shot on someone. And then their name will appear on the screen.
And a little description of who they are and what they're about.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it's sort of like this.
And they'll front load the movie with ten different people.
So like the first time somebody shows up on screen, they get this little dramatis personae kind of description. And it's actually very helpful.
It is.
It is great. And that's how they used to do that in old movies. Like if you watch an old like pre-code Warner Brothers movie, a lot of times they will list the players in the film and, you know, Betty Davis as Cora Johnson or whatever, you know, like they'll actually give you a static shot of each performer. So, you know, going in who they are and
who
they're playing. I love this movie.
Yeah.
A lot.
I really feel like we have been cheated out of Kate Beckinsale.
Mm-hmm.
I know that early on in the 90s, when I saw Cult Comfort Farm.
Yes.
Which is
a delight.
Fantastic. And you should see it. And even like Broke Down Palace, which is not a good movie, but, you know, Claire Danes.
Yes.
And Kate Beckinsale.
Even like Shooting Fish, was that the name of the movie?
I don't remember. But then, and Last Days of Disco, which was also the 90s.
Yes. Also with Chloe Sevigny.
With Stillman, and also with Chloe Sevigny. I feel like we've been cheated out of Kate Beckinsale, because she went off and married whatever his name is.
Let's call him Joe Dingleberry.
I don't remember his name. I know that every time I review one of his movies, I think, oh God, him.
You're the millstone around Kate Beckinsale's neck.
But he's the underworld guy.
And the I, Frankenstein guy.
And the I, Frankenstein guy. And I know that some of y'all out there, Matt Atchity, if he's listening, like those underworld movies, but I would rather take a bullet than watch another one. I was fed up after the first one, and then there were seven others.
And they do well. I mean, it's like, I mean, yes, she's a bankable actress because of these stupid movies, but they are jive, as is Whiteout, which was a great graphic novel.
Another
turned into a
thing.
rotten Kate Beckinsale movie.
This
movie reminds
you.
I've
grown over time to think, if I see her name attached to a movie, I think, oh no, what is it now?
Yeah, wasn't she in the Total Recall? Did he make the Total Recall remake too?
I don't remember.
Ugh.
And so,
up your game, Mr. Beckinsale. That's what I'm saying.
So, we have her back.
Yes.
With the only director she should be working with, honestly.
Yeah.
And she and Chloe Sevigny together
are
like... They are like a great pair from some old 1930s.
They're Marie Dressler and Polly Moran.
Yeah, I just... Chloe Sevigny's face, when she's disgusted with something...
Outrageous!
Is...
It's right up there with...
One of my favorite things in the world, on this planet. Yeah, it's right up there with you look like
a complete
whore. Yeah. We are referring, of course, to the greatest moment that ever happened on Big Love. When
Jennifer Goodwin was getting a job.
Gets a job, comes down to breakfast wearing business
attire.
Very modest and conservative business attire, but because her skirt hits the knee, I think. Chloe Sevigny, with a mouth full of waffle. Not even like, not an actor bite. A mouthful of waffle. Says, you look like a complete whore.
That never gets old.
I can't, I could watch that moment again and again and again and again.
Oh, I hope someone put it on YouTube.
it's one of the reasons I've always really dug Chloe Sevigny, because she has a withering presence that I'm a huge fan of.
Yeah.
And so together they are magical. And this movie is just the kind of funny that when you see it and you love it, you're going to want to watch it again.
Yeah.
And then a year or two from now, you're going to want to see it again. This is Heather's level quotable.
Yes. And even if you're not an Austin person, like if you are an Austin person, this is super in your wheelhouse. There were a bunch of them at that Dallas screening who were just delighted over it.
Right.
But I think even if the words Jane Austen movie make you go, this one, give it a shot.
It has that sort of typical Jane Austen happy ending, but it's the most mercenary and conniving of happy endings, and I adore it.
It relies
every part of
it
me.
Relies upon a certain level of naivete among certain characters.
Yeah, yeah, among most everyone. Yeah, actually, other than the people
directly
running the game,
running the board.
So, yeah, it's great. You should see that.
Definitely.
You can skip Last Days in the Desert.
Mm. Not to be confused with Last Days of Disco.
Yeah, do not be confusing it with that. Last Days in the Desert is from Rodrigo Garcia, who is a contemporary of Iñárritu.
He is the son of Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Do you know that?
Rodrigo Garcia is the son of Gabriel Garcia Marquez?
Yes. Which does not put him on the same level as Gabriel Garcia Marquez, believe
I'll
me.
Say it again. Well, then.
He did, what, 13 Conversations About One Thing and
yeah.
Things You Can Tell Just by Looking at Her. And,
yeah. He's done a lot of indie films that I haven't given two hoots about. Thank you. Thank you for the hoot.
Hoot.
Emmanuel Lubezki shot this, so it looks fantastic. Mm. It's all, you know, unforgiving desert, gorgeous landscape that just
punishes
and devours. It's, you know, five characters. There are five characters.
Right. And two of them are Ewan McGregor.
Two of them are played by Ewan McGregor. Ewan McGregor plays Yeshua. You know him as Jesus. And he also plays the demon / Satan / you know.
Satan?
Right. It's the story of Jesus in the desert for 40 days.
He filmed in real time.
He becomes an adult, yeah. He becomes an adult. He goes off into the desert to seek God, to fast and to pray and to learn what it is that God wants him to do for his mission, his eventual sacrifice.
So finally, a Lent movie.
Basically. And he talks to Satan, and well, they actually sort of snipe at each other a lot. This is the spine of the film. This is the stuff that if you are going to see the film, this is why you're going. To see them with their little back and forth. To watch Ewan McGregor argue with himself. Mostly because the dialogue that comes out of Satan's mouth is the sort of stuff that conservative evangelicals who stumble into this art house film, and most of them won't, will find absolutely offensive. Because
Satan's a real bee.
Satan's a real bee, and he says terrible things about God. And because the same actor is playing Satan, the suggestion is that Jesus' doubts are manifesting themselves in the form of Satan. And this is all perhaps coming from inside of him.
So he's the devil on his own shoulder?
Something like that, yeah.
Okay.
That is the only interesting thing about this film. It is so dramatically inert because the story, and I'm in the minority here. This movie's getting really good reviews. And
I seem to recall Bibbs liking it because it played Sundance 2015.
Bored out of my gourd for the most part. And
did it, was it more familiar to you than it might be to other critics because of your upbringing, or just
no? I'm supposing, you know, I. Anyway, the story is about. Well, the story is an entirely speculative chapter in this sparsely detailed, you know, narrative from the New Testament.
Much like the adventures of young Jesus, earlier this year, whatever that movie was called.
Young Messiah.
Young Messiah, yes. Young Messiah Chronicles.
He meets a family, Kieran Hines, Ayelet Zurer, and Ty Sheridan.
Right.
This is the teenage boy, the kid from Mud.
And he's about to be an X-Men Apocalypse.
And he's also in the Tree of Life, and you know.
Yeah, and he's
discovered by Malick.
Right, I love all three of those actors. I
think and this has some Malicky, you know.
Well, Lubezki shot the Book of Life.
Elements, so, yeah. Know. The Tree of Life.
The Tree of Life, yeah. Right, sorry.
Different. Like I say, beautiful looking film. Shot in the California desert. I had no idea that there was a part of California that looked
so Middle Eastern.
So Middle Eastern and so great.
There's a lot of California we have not traveled to.
That's true, yeah.
By the way, did you get that thing I sent you about the bus that goes overnight
The sleep bus?
The sleep bus.
Who sleeps on the sleep bus?
Well, they've got berths.
I don't know how I feel about this.
I bet you sleep better on the sleep bus than on the sleep train.
Who drives the sleep bus?
Well, professional drivers.
You think so?
Yes.
People who aren't going to fall asleep driving themselves?
Yes, I'm sure that's part of the gig.
I don't know how I feel about that.
All right, well, anyway.
So, also, it's the bus.
Well, yes, but you'd be asleep.
Have you ever gone anywhere in real life a long distance on a bus?
Oh, yeah.
On a Greyhound?
It sucks. But yeah. This is different. It's all sleeping berths, and then if you want to stay up, there's like...
And how do you keep the bad people away from you on the sleep bus? How do you keep an eye on your stuff? How do you keep an eye on the bad robbers and the touchers?
I'm sure you check baggage and you just keep things with you in your berth, you know, your immediate stuff.
Listen, I just finished watching most all except one episode of 60 Days In, where folks go to prison. And you know what those cats do? They sleep with all their stuff on their bunk with them, sort of like under them.
Sure.
Like nobody touches. Any of you touch my stuff.
Calm down, Francis.
Yeah. It's light. The line is lighten up.
Lighten up, Francis. Like, sorry, yes.
So, now I want to be on a... No. I don't want to be on the sleep bus.
Look, it's 48 bucks to San Francisco. And it's an overnight sleepy trip where you have your own bed. It would be like in the Palm Beach story. Maybe I could step on your face.
I have a feeling it won't be anything like the Palm Beach story.
Fine. All right.
I'm thinking you're probably wrong.
All right. Anyway, they're in the desert.
And there is a sort of parallel antagonistic father-son dynamic playing out. Kieran Hines is like building an altar, and the kid is... 15, 16, wants out of there. He wants to go to Jerusalem and...
Party.
And be a barista, whatever. The mom is dying. She's sick. She's dying. And the kid is rightly thinking, what happens? She dies, and then what? I stay out in the desert alone with my father for the rest of my life and then take care of him when he dies, and then what? I'm alone in the desert. Then what do I do?
He's got a point.
Indeed, he does. But Kieran Hines is, you know, no, you stay here and you be a part of this family, and this is the tradition of the child obeys the parents and does the stuff and, you know, takes care of them, you know. When we die at 37 years old, we must be taken care of by you. So that's playing out, and Jesus hangs around and listens to them and stays on and helps the dad build the altar and listens to the kid and talks to the kid. And that's it. No kidding. That's it. Until the end when the normal stuff that you already know happens. Hmm. You know.
Well, so, like, where does it end? I mean, does he get crucified or does he ride the donkey back into town? What are we talking?
It ends with stuff happening to the family
uh-huh.
that I suppose I shouldn't spoil.
Okay.
The minute that's over, we jump to the crucifixion.
Oh.
And then to another ending in the present day. So it's
really,
yeah, it's, and I know that's a spoiler, but here's the deal. If y'all, you know, y'all know the story, then you know this story, and this other stuff is, the other stuff I haven't spoiled.
Okay.
Frankly, for you. So I didn't really give anything away of note. This is
that ending where they disappear around polite. A corner in Manhattan, and then, yes. like, all the modern office workers come out, and then yeah. Day by Day plays again?
Yeah, totally, just okay. like that.
Gotcha.
It is a very polite, restrained, dignified film, as though Mr. Garcia is nervous about something.
Hedging his bets?
Yeah. Doesn't want to offend anybody, and doesn't know either what he wants to say or if he wants to make a, you know, a parallel between Jesus and God and Ty Sheridan and Kieran Hines. He accomplishes that, but without much emotional heft.
Huh.
I really found it to be quite dull, and I, like I say, I am in the minority.
Well, I'm wondering if some of the reviews are overly kind just because most of the
Any Jesus movie is any decent Jesus movie is better than 95% of the ones that we get.
Yes. Yeah. They're basically giving it extra points for not being God's Not Dead 3.
Right. I know. Here's my personal problem. Films that are about... someone on Facebook said... What don't you like movies like RoboCop that are Jesus allegories? And I said, well, yeah, I do. And my problem is films that are about Jesus as Jesus,
mm-hmm.
it's really hard to make that story sing in a new way. Yeah. It's been done a lot of times. And for some reason, it's really hard to make this person who is, you know, arguably one of history's most fascinated upon figures.
Right.
Why is it so hard to make him interesting in a movie?
Because too many people are too prone to get too upset if you color outside of these very sort of rigidly defined catechism school lines. I mean...
Absolutely.
I mean, The Last Temptation of Christ even doesn't go to bananas and look how people flipped out.
Correct. People who hadn't seen the film.
Of course, yes.
Trumped up.
It's always people who haven't seen the film.
Yeah. So, you know, films that have a Christ figure, like RoboCop,
mm-hmm.
like Ozar Baltasar,
Jesus Lion.
Like Narnia, you know. Those are far more interesting films.
Yeah.
Because you have freedom.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know...
Look, you can't even show Mohammed, so, you know.
Right, and I think that's what Christianity should just do.
Just ban all...
Yeah, Christianity should just say, hey, by the way, we've changed our rules. no more depicting this person. Because you can't do it right.
But then,
half the time he's blonde with blue eyes.
I say, what will the makers of those people who have, like, you know, soccer playing Jesus, little statuettes do? You know, drive them right out of business.
Capital punishment.
Yeah, that's a, no.
Look, the Old Testament loves capital punishment.
Yeah, I know.
The Old Testament's like, are your children disobedient? Unleash a pack of wild animals and let them be devoured. Like, seriously, that's Old Testament stuff.
All right, so yeah.
So I'm not, no, don't, it's not good.
Okay, so that's...
It's not good.
That's the movie you saw that I didn't see. The movie I saw that you didn't see, also not good, or not particularly good, was High Rise, which is the new Ben Wheatley film based on the novel by J.G. Ballard. You know, it's... As we were talking about with the flick, and I said, well, when they were describing the plot, I said, well, this sounds like if you took the train from Snowpiercer and stuck it on one end, and that's basically what it is, because it's this super high-tech high-rise in the 1970s, and, you know, you have kind of your lowlies down on the lower floors, and then the higher up you get, the more rich and aristocratic, until you get to the very top, which is the penthouse that's owned by the architect, who's played by Jeremy Irons, and he's got, like, a horse up there. And a giant garden and stuff. And so we follow Tom Hiddleston, who was a doctor.
What kind of garden? Flowers or food? Or what?
Flowers. But he's got like sheep up there and stuff too. Anyway, so Tom Hiddleston is this doctor of physiology who moves into the building. And, you know, at first it's all very glam and high tech. And slowly but surely, like, for reasons that aren't fully explained, and it's certainly not explained why people don't just leave the building, which according to Matt Atchity, the book does explain, everyone sort of reverts to barbarism. And there's just like, you know.
Would I like that part?
Maybe. There's like just, you know, I mean, you wouldn't like the garbage everywhere, but, you know, they.
And I hate it when things are dirty.
I know. But it just, yeah, society breaks down and it's all metaphorical and blah, blah, blah.
And it's all metaphorical and blah, blah, blah.
Pretty much. And it is less interesting than it could have been because it's one of those movies where they start at the ending. And then tell you, you know, like 5 months earlier.
What happened?
Well, yeah. And it's like, how did we get here? And it's sort of like, all right, well, if we spend the whole movie knowing that eventually this is all going to fall apart and you know, be a horrifying dystopia, well, then that's, you just surrendered your one interesting card, you know? the production design is great. It's very sort of 70s glam. It's not unlike Space Station 76 in that respect in terms of, you know, what the 70s idea of what the future was going to look like. But ultimately, I just found it kind of disappointing. And this is the second Ben Wheatley movie I've seen, and I didn't like the other one either. And I don't know why this guy is such a big honking deal, but he apparently is.
What was the first one? Remind me.
The other one that I saw, I want to say it was Kill List, but I have to double check. It's the one about that where it's like there's a big twist ending involving like satanic cults or something, which is super obvious in the first 10 minutes of the movie.
I see.
And there's nothing worse than a twist movie where you know what the twist is, and so why are you there? You know, because that's all I got. Yeah, this one I liked the look of it. I liked, you know, it's an interesting cast. It's, you know, Tom Hiddleston and Sienna Miller and Elizabeth Moss and Luke Evans and Jeremy Irons, but I just ultimately did not care.
Why don't we structure this episode by talking about the one we love, the other one we didn't like, the other one we didn't like, the other one we didn't like, and then end with the other one we love.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, nicely balanced that way.
Sure. Well, that brings us to Money Monster.
Talk about that while I try not to cough again.
Okay. So this is the fourth film from director Jodie Foster. And
Little Ned Tate.
Yes.
Ouch, it's Thanksgiving.
Yes.
What's the other one?
The Beaver.
Oh, The Beaver! I didn't hate The Beaver.
I didn't like The Beaver.
I didn't hate Little Man Tate much.
I like Little Man Tate okay. I did not care
whatever
for...
Whatever the other one is called.
Home for the Holidays.
Right.
Did not care for that one much. Did not care for The Beaver all that much. Although it is I think Jennifer Lawrence's first films. Like, it might be post Winter's Bone, pre-Hunger Games.
Where does House at the End of the Street fit in?
I think that came later. Anyway, so George Clooney stars as a very Jim Cramer-ish cable show host who does a show about finance and stock tips. And
he's awful. He's got his own, you know, fly girls and stuff like that.
Yeah, like he's a joke. But obviously somehow taken very seriously nonetheless, and with this very popular program. And Julia Roberts is his long-suffering director slash floor producer, you know, voice in his ear on the headset lady.
Right.
And one day, this guy played by Jack O'Connell, who was in Unbroken and 71, shows up with a gun.
So, yeah, he's unrecognizable.
Yeah, yeah, and they give him this.
You've seen him in the other films. You're...
And they give him a very New York accent.
They sure do.
Which is a little ridiculous. He takes everyone hostage. He holds a gun on the place. He makes Clooney put on a bomb vest. He has sunk his life savings into a tip from Clooney that did not work out. And now he wants answers. And those answers involve a CEO who was supposed to be on the show that day but didn't show up. And so suddenly there's some sleuthing afoot to find out exactly what happened and why. This is another one of those movies where it is about a very timely subject,
yeah,
about the economy and about the people who run it and about, yeah, the people who are running it into the ground and, right, who are exploiting the people who don't understand how things work. And rather than be a condemnation of the system as it exists, the way that The Big Short was, it becomes about a bad person who did a bad thing and is going to be punished for it, like 99 Homes was.
Right.
And I don't have time for the latter. There are too many people.
I have time for the latter if there is enough of an indictment of the system.
Well, there never.
And there's a little bit of that.
There's
in this
a
movie,
little bit of that one in this one, and a little bit in 99 Homes. But do not let me leave the theater thinking, "Oh, phew, arrests were made." Because you know what? You know what doesn't happen in real life? Arrests.
Yeah.
No one is behind bars for this stuff. And don't blow smoke into any of my orifices movie by suggesting otherwise. So that's part of the problem. The other part of the problem is
the major problem is that it's not
dull.
It's not especially suspenseful.
Yeah, it's not well told at all. The characters aren't drawn very well. It's interesting from the point of view that the female characters are.
Yeah, I don't
a lot,
know much about Clooney or Julia Roberts' characters.
Not really.
Really at all.
We know that Clooney's like three times divorced and,
right,
is kind of a shallow jerk, and he says he hasn't had dinner by himself since 1986 or something.
Right.
And, you know, Julia Roberts is hardworking, long-suffering, blah, blah, blah.
She's the smartest person in the room.
Of course, yeah. The women in this movie are the smartest people in the room. They're the ones...
I liked that.
That is a cool facet of it.
I liked that.
Yeah,
very slyly, Jodie Foster has made a movie where the men are all dopes.
Yeah.
Or criminals.
Or victims.
Or victims who are now becoming
criminals.
Criminals themselves.
Julia
and
Robert-
the women are the ones telling the truth, organizing sanity.
Yeah. Trying to fix things.
And trying to fix things.
So you got Julia Roberts, you've got her like field producer who's dealing with stuff. You've got the spokesperson for the CEO that no one can find, who's played by the woman from Outland. Is that the name of that show?
I think yes.
Who's from Outland? And then you've got the girlfriend of the kidnapper who turns out to be somebody interesting all on her own.
She's the best.
There are a couple of scenes that I liked in this movie because they completely subvert what you expect. Like they are set up as these very sort of like, one of them is this very sort of hokey Frank Capra moment that they're going for that just does not go that way.
I'll tell you, when they started doing that bit,
mm-hmm,
I thought, seriously? This is going to happen right here? Is this really going to happen?
And then it doesn't.
And then I was surprised. Yeah.
Happily
surprised.
Yeah. And the couple of things that did catch me by surprise, and I admire that. But overall, I didn't care, and I wasn't stoked to anger the way the movie wants me to be, because it's very wishy-washy about what it has to say about the world as it exists right now.
I fully agree with you. I'm trying not to cough, so I'm not going to comment too much about this. It's just not a very good film, and there is a kind of laughably terrible hip-hop track over the closing credits by, I want to say Dan the Automator and Del the Funky Homo Sapien, which is, you know, I expect a little better from those guys.
Well, just wait until a couple of weeks when we talk about Alice Through the Looking Glass and the Pink song that pops up over the closing credits out of nowhere. in a movie that's been set in the 19th century. Yeah.
That wouldn't bother me at all.
It will when you hear it. yeah, so this is an annoying movie. And, we were talking about this on What the Flick, that it's, she's I think it's Foster's attempt to make her own inside job.
Yeah.
Which she was in for Spike Lee, and actually she hired Matthew Libatique to shoot it.
An inside job is so great.
Oh, yeah. And it works as a suspense film, but it also says things about the world.
Yeah.
It has a point to it, and Money Monster does not quite pull off either of those things.
I wish it did. I really dig Julia Roberts.
Of course.
She doesn't have a lot to do here, unfortunately. No. And
I like the idea of the movies that Clooney wants to make. He wants to make these movies that are about current events and about how journalism works and about,
right.
You know, how the government lies to us or whatever. But more often than not, that instinct takes him to these movies that don't quite work.
Very often they fall flat.
Yeah.
I have a feeling, you know, there's a certain type of liberal filmmaking that is too comfortable to be really as incendiary as it would like to be.
Yeah, I suppose
made,
so.
Made by comfortable people.
Right.
And
well, they want
it's hard to manufacture the kind of rage that you need.
They want to make movies that are about pressing issues, but at the same time they're operating a very sort of audience friendly, studio friendly mindset, and it's very hard to reconcile those two.
I know
things.
I come off as all class war all the time, but how can you not?
And
you live in the world,
yeah.
Really. How can you not?
And if you look at a movie like The Big Short, you know, that is corporate filmmaking that is not afraid to name names and point fingers.
Correct.
And be specific.
Who saw The Big Short? Did people go see that movie?
Yeah, it did
Was
well.
It a hit enough?
It was a hit enough. It was nominated for many awards.
I wish I'd understood the mechanics of the stuff they were talking about.
Look, if...
But... I get it.
If Margot Robbie in a bathtub can't explain this stuff to you,
she kind of did.
Then I don't know who can.
She sort of kind of did.
All right. That's bringing us to the movie that we really loved. I would say both Love and Friendship and The Lobster have a very good chance of being on my top 10
list. Two of the best
year.
Films of 2016 are being released this week.
Yes.
Yeah.
They're both in limited release, but they're both expanding. So
I'm going to say...
if they aren't where you are now, they'll be there soon.
Yeah. Go. When you get a chance, if they're not near you right now, they're really only on a few screens in very big cities this week. But when you get your chance to see them, please do it. While you're waiting, you could look at other Whit Stillman films.
Yes.
All of them are... delightful in their own ways.
And Criterion is putting out a whole box set now of the first three of Metropolitan, Barcelona, and Last Days of Disco.
And if you've got a taste for a little, you know, tougher business, Yorgos Lanthimos, mm-hmm. I'm sure I'm killing his name, Greek filmmaker behind The Lobster. Before this, he made Alps, ALPS, and Dogtooth. Dogtooth is about a family sort of being sequestered by the father.
Right.
And kept in the dark about the way the world operates and fed lies about the world. All the way down to what words mean.
Yeah. It's like if the village were a family.
Yes. Alps is even stranger, honestly. It's about a troupe of amateur actors who rent themselves to the families and friends of people who have recently died. And the actors portray the recently deceased person to ease the family's grief and to help them sort of transition into a life without the person they loved. But they're not very good actors. So they don't ever really approximate the person that they're meant to approximate. And so trouble arises from this. Anyway, catch up on those while you're waiting for The Lobster.
Or go see Sing Street, for that matter.
Which is tanking unjustly,
yeah,
like sweetly lovable, adorable Sing Street.
Yes.
Tell the plot of The Lobster.
Okay.
So I can save my voice.
All right. Yes, Dave has a lot to say about this movie. In fact, when I saw it, he spent the entire ride home explaining it to me before I could even get a word out about what my own opinion might have been.
I was explaining it to you. I was telling you what I thought about it.
Yes.
There's a whole... explaining it to you suggests that somehow I was sort of like simultaneously patting you on the head and... standing on a ladder looking down at
well,
you
we,
while I
we
said...
we were not having a conversation about
no,
it.
No, I was very excited because
you were declaiming.
I was so excited to have a conversation about it. Finally, I'd been waiting like...
3 days.
72 whole hours. to talk to you about this movie. I was just stoked to do it.
Yes.
And the minute I said it, you're like, oh, mansplaining, blah, 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 blah.
Well, I mean, we were almost home from the archive before you even... asked me what I thought.
We don't live that far from the Ark Light.
Anyway, all right. Colin Farrell plays David. David, as we at the beginning of the film, is being tossed out of a relationship.
Dumped.
Yes. And asked never to return. But there's no Felix Unger here. He is put on a bus and sent to the hotel. And at the hotel, we find out that... in this society, if you are single, you have 45 days to fall in love and find someone to be with. If you do not do that in that period of time, you will be turned into the animal of your choice.
Yes.
Most people choose dogs because people love dogs, and that's their last chance of getting any sort of human affection. But Farrell would like to be a lobster so that he can live for 100 years and remain sexually fruitful and have blue blood like an aristocrat. And he likes the sea. So he suffers the bizarre sort of social setup of this hotel where the, you know, men and women are desperately trying to come together, most often linking up because of either a shared infirmity or the scantest of things in common. Also, as an activity, the people at the hotel have to go on these hunts through the woods where they track down people who had previously bolted from the hotel and are living in the woods.
They are known as loners.
As loners, exactly. At some point, Farrell himself, after failing to fake his way through a relationship with a woman known as the Heartless Woman.
Heartless Woman, and if you see Dogtooth and Alps... you'll recognize her.
She, oh, okay.
Her name is Angeliki Papadou, the Greek.
Yes.
Name. Yeah.
Eventually.
Sorry, lady in the movie. I can't get your name right.
After failing to make that relationship work, he himself becomes a loner and goes off to live in the woods with a group of people led by Léa Seydoux from Blue is Warmest Color. He then finds himself falling for... fellow loner Rachel Weisz, because she, like him, is myopic. And, yeah. Complications ensue.
I don't want to give away too many plot details.
Yeah.
Because there are so many...
There's a wonderful unfolding...
surprises.
...absurdity to the whole story. Yeah. But as bizarre and sort of Terry Gilliam-ish as the plot, as the premise is... this is a very cold, cold, deadpan, like, no one is, this is super, super dry. Despite the fact that it has a lot of great British comedy people in it, like Olivia Colman and Ashley Jenkins.
It is a comedy.
It is a comedy, but in a very...
it's a comedy for a very specific person.
Yeah, like John C. Reilly is in it, and I'm sure that his Tim and Eric work prepared him for this level of stone-facedness.
Right.
And absurdity. Even though I don't like Tim and Eric all
I
much.
Love this movie so much, and love is probably the wrong word to use in any kind of association with this film, because in spite of the fact that it's about people who are frantic to couple, none of them are in love.
No.
And no one feels love.
No. They're being forced to...
Everyone in this film is in a blank kind of daze. And what's so magnificent to me, one of the things that is so magnificent to me about this film is the performances are lifeless. And I mean that
in the best way.
In the most complimentary way. Colin Farrell has done something here that if you don't already know how good he is from In Bruges or Ondine, is that what it's called?
Yeah,
Ondine? Was
Ondine.
That, yeah. You know, get woke to Colin Farrell.
Yeah.
This man is, as we've discussed before, leading man looks, character actor.
Soul.
In his heart, yeah. And, you know, he gained 40 pounds to be in this. And it's a detail that's never really discussed. But he, the film opens and there he is, freshly dumped from a relationship with all that I was married fat.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I took myself off the market.
Yeah. I got married. I gained 40 pounds. I'm happy. And so that informs, you know, who he is, but the movie doesn't make a show of it.
No, his performance is like somebody reading stereo instructions.
Yeah.
But in the most heartbreaking way possible.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so moving to watch these people behave like robots.
Mm.
I loved all the details of the story. Again, things that are barely talked about. The way they padlock your hand on the first day to make you
appreciate pears.
Yeah. The punishments for, you know, touching yourself, the punishments for any kind of pleasure.
Yeah.
The production design is so great. You know, these narrow hallways and narrow staircases and these single beds and everything just feels...
Those grim seaside British hotels.
Everything feels so completely hemmed in until you get people in a big room or a big field or a big swimming pool area, and then it feels as though that scenery is going to just swallow them. So it's this combination of production design and just great cinematography. It's beautiful to look at. The story is strange and dark and sad.
There's even narration that makes sense as to why it's there and is incorporated contextually into the film in an interesting way. Because so often that's such a... It feels like it's a last resort they came up with in post to like bridge two scenes together or you know, explain a lot of exposition. But it's delivered so... in that weirdly matter-of-fact voice that the whole film has, but then there's a point where you come to realize why it's been there, and it's great.
The darkness of the film, as well, is such that it's relentless.
Yeah.
Because even if you do Logan's Run your way out into the woods with the loners...
They have their own set of rules.
They got their own problems.
Yeah.
And you realize there's nowhere to go.
Right.
It doesn't matter what you do. There's nowhere to go.
And it's one of those films that was shot in Ireland, right?
Yeah.
Where, like, no one ever looks warm.
Right.
It's just always cold and damp and bleh.
Right. And so I think one of the things that what I love the most about it is it's like a sharp, stabby knife. About, you know, aimed at the way a big, big, mean knife aimed at the way human beings treat other human beings and the way we police each other's happiness, the way we set up arbitrary, absurd rules for coupling or love or any other kind of relationship that you would prefer to be in with someone.
How we've complicated what should be a natural process.
An intuitive, biological thing.
Yeah.
Has turned into, over the course of, you know...
Millennia.
Millions of years of human behavior. Into absolute oppression.
Mm.
And it makes a mockery of other romantic films where, you know, the answer is either falling in love or the answer is I'm going to go off and make it on my own, single. I'm living out loud. You know, like, it's...
All the choices suck.
All the choices suck here. It's so great.
Where it was a little
like
late.
Like I said when I posted about it, I want to marry it and divorce it and become a tortoise. Because that's my animal.
One of our British listeners was saying, "What, you're only just now getting that?" This movie screened at the premiere of the Cannes Film Festival in 2015.
Opened all over Europe.
It was originally acquired by a company called Alchemy that I think pretty much went bankrupt, and so then A24 picked it up, and now A24 is releasing it, and that's actually the perfect company for this movie.
Right.
You know, this is a movie that needs the people who knew how to sell Under the Skin.
Right. Yes.
So it's a happy ending in a way.
This stuff always comes to us last anyway. If it plays at Cannes and gets a big, you know, reception there, and if it's from a filmmaker that's not American, that doesn't already have a history of American distribution in place, that film opens 8 to 10 to 12 to 16 months later in the United States.
That's true. Yeah, like the new Almodovar is premiering at Cannes. It's already played Spain, and I think it's gonna play France and other places before we finally get it later this year.
All right. Yeah.
I want it.
Yeah, I know. I know. You're
okay.
He's your godfather. What's the word?
Padrino.
He's your padrino. Yeah.
All right. What's your DVD pick?
It's Alive. You know when you're homesick on the couch?
When you're homesick on the couch.
When any thinking human being is homesick on the couch.
This is not the movie that most people would
When pick. Any good person
no.
who loves life in cinema is homesick on the couch, first thing you do...
Look for Sandra Bullock movies.
Get a big cup of tea. Look for whatever Sandra Bullock movie you haven't seen lately. And by that, I mean, you want to watch The Lake House. And
Or Practical Magic.
Or Practical Magic. But The Lake House is really the best one when you're sick. Because that's the one with the time-traveling mailbox.
Yes.
Failing that film, perhaps you happen to have a 1932 Barbara Stanwyck movie, Saved in TiVo, that you've been sort of like thinking you're going to watch. You watch that one. And that's good, but it's from 1932, so it's only 66 minutes long.
It'll only take you so far.
Yeah.
What was that one called?
Shopworn. She plays a waitress who falls in love with a snooty... He's a rich
family.
College boy. His snooty family disapproves of her, thinks she's cheap and common.
A gold digger.
They have no evidence for this, other than that, she's a waitress and she's sassy. Like when guys come into the other college boys come in the restaurant, they're always trying to like goose her and
make time
stuff. Yeah, and I wrote down my favorite lines. Guy, one of the college boys, "How about a little service for me, baby?" She goes, "That's the way little boys get hurt." when the college boy that she falls in love with meets her, he kind of insults her. He kind of negs her at first, which she's not having. This isn't even like a, ooh, I like this one. Like, it's not like that at all. She doesn't like him at all. He forgets his hat, and she runs out of the cafe at him and yells, "Hey, stupid, you forgot your hat." And so the snooty family, once they finally do fall in love, the snooty family has her arrested on a morals violation. They don't explain what that is.
You didn't have to.
What she did. What they think she did. She didn't do anything. They have her committed to an institution, the State Home for the Regeneration of Females. No kidding. I'm only guessing that things like this existed back in the United States in the good old days.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Make America great again, everybody.
Then she gets out and becomes famous and rich and falls in love, and the family apologizes.
No, actually, they it's not until she basically says that she will dump the guy and does it within earshot of the mother realizes that she's been horrible and, you know, yeah, these kids should stay together. Anyway, so It's Alive.
It's Alive is obviously the one about the 1974 film about the people. There's only one thing wrong with the Davis baby. I'll tell you what that one thing that's wrong with the Davis baby is.
What's that?
You don't see enough of it. Nor do you see enough of it eating people's bodies, which is what you really want to see. You see a lot of red paint splashed around. And you see a guy in a rubber baby suit going, ah.
Wait,
but just glimpses. And then there's a baby puppet.
Whoa. Full-grown man in a baby suit?
Probably a child.
I see. Okay.
But it's in a rubber suit, his tongue sticking out going, ah. And then there's like a baby puppet.
Rubber baby bubby?
Rubber baby puppet. Yeah. And they're magnificently cheap and terrible. Yes. Such a great movie about such a disgusting thing. And the performances are weird. Larry Cohen is such a really incredibly oddball filmmaker.
Yes, we also watched God Told Me To.
God Told Me, yeah, God Told Me To. We watched that the night before, which is also Larry Cohen, about a
string of murders in New York where all the people say, God told me to.
Yeah, and it turns out that, well, I don't want to spoil it.
Oh, yeah, no, find out for yourself.
Yeah, it's just so great.
It's stupid, but it's interesting.
I love his movies. The stuff, you know what you need to watch? The Stuff just came out on DVD.
That's your DVD pick then?
Yeah, okay, Larry Cohen stuff. Movie from the 80s.
Yeah, there's a new Blu-ray from Scream
about
Factory.
A dessert.
That's so addictive.
A dessert that... It harms you.
Like most desserts.
Like most desserts. Yeah. The Stuff.
All right. Well, speaking of dessert, my DVD pick this week is Cupcakes. It's an Israeli film from Eitan Fox, who's best known for Yossi and Jaeger and The Bubble. This one is about Eurovision, and since in honor of Eurovision happening this week and playing on American television for the first time, it reminded me of this movie, which is silly and frothy, but still worth a look. It's fun. It's about this group of friends in Tel Aviv who get together every year to watch the, I think it's called the Universe Song Contest. Like, it's Eurovision, but they can't call it Eurovision. And
what do they call it in the Apple?
That's the World Vision.
World Vision.
Yeah. Yes, World Vision. Anyway, so...
love the universal melody.
La, 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 la. do the BM. Anyway, so this group of friends in Tel Aviv are watching the competition. They hate the Israeli entry. One of them just had a breakup, and so the other ones, to cheer her up, like... come up with this song off the cuff and sing it to her. Anyway, somebody films it on their phone and it goes on, gets viral on social media, and they get selected to be the Israeli team for the following year. And so it's just all about their nutty hijinks going to Eurovision and as fans of this goofy thing. It's kind of a dopey movie, but there aren't a lot of movies about Eurovision, and it's cute, and Fox is an interesting filmmaker. I wish somebody would release his miniseries, I think it's called Mary Lou. I saw it at Outfest a few years ago, and it's this amazing, like, 4-hour story about this kid whose mother runs off when he's very young, and he becomes a drag queen and sort of creates this one-man show about her life that he performs, and it all has to do with it all ties into the songs of this Israeli pop star, so it's sort of like Mamma Mia, where like it's a jukebox musical for this guy whose name I can't remember now. But anyway, Cupcakes is my DVD pick. Should we do some letters?
No.
Dave!
I'm done with talking.
I offered to read letters this week.
But see, it provokes a conversation.
All right.
And Okay. People don't even know that we've paused this podcast about four times already so that I can
hack your guts out.
Right. Well, and I'm finished with my voice.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Well, because we asked people to write us letters, and they did, and now we aren't reading them.
Listen.
And so, you know.
They know the deal. The letters get read when they get read.
All right. All right. Well, we appreciate
them. We love
them.
All of you.
Keep the letters coming by
so
all
much,
means.
And your emails.
Linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
They'll get done.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us.
Oh. Yes. One more thing to say. Those of you who have subscribed and joined the club, I said this yesterday on LKTV, but I think I should say it here just in case people are missing it. All your prizes are coming.
Yes.
That is a fact. They are, the mugs are here. They came earlier in the week, but I haven't had a minute to deal with them because I've been on my back.
And not in the good way.
Naughty.
Well, that was a T-ball just sitting there.
Yeah. I have not been well, and so that's what's going on. They're coming. Everything else is coming. This is moving a lot more slowly than I anticipated.
Yes.
But it's moving. It's kind of like letters, although it'll move faster than letters. Okay, now I'm officially done talking.
Okay.
Here's what you can do. You can be the one to say goodbye this week.
Ooh, golly. Yeah. Well, then before we get to that, quick reminder also for club members, a couple things you should know about. One, we have posted our latest Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episode for the Darden Brothers 2 Days, One Night. And if you are a club level member at $7 and up a month, you get it for free, and it's there waiting for you at the Patreon site. If you are not a member, however, you can buy it a la carte. Two of you have thus far.
Okay, I have to talk again.
We hope that more of you will.
Here's what I love. I love that when we do a movie that, like, everybody knows,
mm-hmm.
it sells.
Yeah.
And this one, and it's entirely my fault because I railroaded this one through.
Mm-hmm.
This Belgian film about, you know.
Unemployment. And depression.
and clinical depression. Two of you hardy souls
have chosen
to buy it. Thank both of you by name if I had your names written down here. And the rest of you, you know what? I don't even care. Like, I understand.
It looks good on the resume.
The subject matter probably seems dire, but this is such an incredible movie.
It is really great.
And it actually ends hopefully, if that's what you're worried about. So, you know what? I don't care.
Anyway,
I know two of you are my friends.
If you are not already a Patreon member and you want to buy that episode, PayPal us $1.99 at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com and let us know where to send it. Of course, you can still buy the other 11 commentary podcasts that we did. It's everything from Die Hard and Clue and Josie and the Pussycats to The Apple and Two for the Road and Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and The Poseidon Adventure. There's a whole ton of them. They're all listed at linoleum-knife.com. Our website. Also, if you are a $12 and up Patreon member, we have another club meeting happening this Saturday night where we'll be watching Otto Preminger's classic film noir, Laura, and we'll be doing that starting at 6 p.m. Pacific Daylight Time, and we'll be streaming it and chatting about it as it unfolds. So it's a great movie. Come join us for that if you are free this Saturday night. All right, check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Go to the Rotten Tomatoes show podcast with Matt and Gray. Check out the B-Movies podcast with Bibbs and Whitney. And, of course, their new show, Canceled Too Soon. I may be going on soon, hopefully, to talk about the dearly departed Muppets from ABC that just got axed after a season. We'll see if we can get that happening. Check out the Joel Ryan thing, Sewers of Paris, the Bret Easton Ellis podcast, the Fat Guys at the Movies, the Criterion cast, the Game Night Guys, Film Spotting, SVU, and Secretly Timid. Of course, thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Find out more about all of his great projects at Bluetopia.com, Bluetopia. Like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LinoleumCast. Leave us a review on iTunes, please. Stream us at Stitcher Radio. It turns out, by the way, if you are leaving us reviews on iTunes in other countries, we have no way of knowing that, because we can't access the iTunes of other countries. So Willem from the Netherlands sent us a screen grab of the review that he left us on Dutch iTunes, and we're very appreciative. So if you are in another part of the world where we can't see the iTunes reviews, send us your review and let us know that you did it. We really appreciate it. Linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. It's been lovely, and Dave will be in better shape next week, we promise. And I want to thank all the listeners for a lovely birthday present that I received this week from Amazon, because the gift card said it was from all the listeners. So collectively, whether or not you kicked in on this gift, you gave me a really cool comics a compilation. A collection of Herbie the Fat Fury. He's going to hit you with his lollipop. So very excited about that. I'm looking forward to reading it. But yeah, it's my birthday this week, so thank you all for that. And we'll catch you next time. Goodbye.